Good morning and welcome to Books and Arts on RN with me, Michael Cathcart. Nice to be with you this morning for the third meeting of RN's 2016 African Book Club. And we're discussing the acclaimed novel Things Fall Apart by the Nigerian author Chinua Achebe this morning. It tells the story of a man named Okonkwo, who's a respected Nigerian tribal leader. And since this book was published in 1958, it's acquired an enormous international reputation. It sold more than 10 million copies worldwide. And if you're a younger listener, you might have read it at school. It's very common on school syllabuses. So in the following hour, we'll be discussing Achebe's representation of the traditional culture of the Igbo people and his take on the whole experience of British colonialism, the impact of British colonialism. So do stay with us for the African Book Club here on Books and Arts. And, of course, the show is made by your comments, so do send me your thoughts on this book, your comments throughout the hour. You can leave a comment on our Facebook page, or you can tweet me at RN Books and Arts, that's RN Books and Arts on Twitter, or you can text us on 0418 22 65 76, 0418 22 65 76. I'd love to know what you make of this book. Do you see it as illuminating the African experience? Do you find it troubling that the book is written in English? Do you find yourself judging the culture in that village, or do you want to stand back and say it's not for me to judge? So many issues to discuss, and to help us to discuss these, we're joined by three fabulous guests. In our studios in Tamworth is Dr. John Adeleke, who is a Nigerian-Australian academic. He's also a writer and a novelist. He writes as Dapo Adeleke. John, good morning. Nice to have you with us.
Good morning.
And with us in our Melbourne studios is Sister Zizanda. Hello.
Hi.
Nice to have you here. You're the organiser of the Pan-African Poets Cafe.
Yes, a very recent project. We've had about 8 open mic sessions.
Sounds like a wonderful thing.
Lots of fun.
We should do a whole story about that.
That sounds great.
Let's do that. And shortly we'll be joined by Emeritus Professor Gareth Griffiths from the University of Western Australia, who's an expert on African writing. We've heard him before and he'll be along in just a tick. So let's start with you, John. Perhaps you can give us a sense of what was happening in the 1890s in Nigeria. Just a very brief history lesson. What was going on at that moment when this book is set?
In the early 1980s, we had a colonial incursion into Nigeria, and then it was a great incident that devastated the culture and the traditional setup of the society, and that is precisely what Achebe tries to recount in Things Fall Apart.
Yeah, so that's that great impact of the arrival of the British colonists there in the 1890s.
Exactly.
And where does this novel take place? Where does it happen?
It takes place in Umuofia, which is in the eastern part of Nigeria, and then Umuofia comprises 9 villages, and then the focus of the setting is on Igbo society of that particular time.
So the name of the whole group of the villages is Umuofia.
Umuofia. Yeah, exactly.
We'll learn how to say that. So, Sister Zai, what's the main character? Tell us about him, Okonkwo.
Okonkwo is a very interesting man, and you can't understand Okonkwo without understanding his father, Onoka, or rather his response to his father. He perceives his own father as the opposite of his definition, Okonkwo's own definition of manliness
and
what it means to be a man.
Sissy.
Well, pretty much. You know, he doesn't like the fact that his father didn't work very hard, and so Okonkwo was a very hard worker. And he's also known to be very hard on his wives, which is an interesting part of the novel we can take up later.
Let's talk about that later, yes.
But he's a man. He's a self-made man. He's had to make his money for himself. He didn't inherit anything from his father, which is maybe a point of resentment from him. But it's also a point where people in his own society see him as a hero. He's a wrestler. You know, he was able to...
In fact, the story opens with a wrestling match.
That's it. And he was able to, defeat the man called the Cat, Amalinza the Cat, the man whose back never touched the ground. This is Okonkwo. He's like a warrior. He's brave. He's a hard worker. He's got, you know, three wives, eight children. He's a man with many titles. So he's a man with high status in the society and a man who demands a lot of respect. But he's also very rash. And... he can be quite violent.
Well, he's a traditionalist, isn't he? I mean, he really is committed to very traditional ways. Even his friends say, come on, ease up. You know, we don't have to obey these rules in such a inflexible way.
Well, I think the question, when we start talking about African tradition, especially when we're talking about the colonial encounter, we have to then start asking the question, what is tradition? You know,
yes.
Because a lot of things have been invented. There is the concept of invented tradition, and of course, I'm very aware that as a Southern African, I have had a very different experience of colonization as opposed to West African. So,
but this question of tradition also confronts people when they undergo a migrant experience, when they travel overseas, because you get people who will have a very fixed idea of what the traditions of the old country was, and other people say, no, it was much more flexible than that, and you get arguments around exactly that kind of issue.
Yes, and you find that. Isolated pockets of Italian culture in Melbourne are probably a better historical record than anything you'll find in Italy, yeah. I've heard.
Yes, no, absolutely I've right. Heard. No, that's the way it works. So, John, let's plunge into this and look at one of the issues that, one of the incidents that occurs very early on. So Okonkwo takes a boy called Ikemefuna under his wing. It's as a result of a dispute, he ends up looking after this child who's from a neighbouring village. Just tell us about the arrival of this boy. How does he change the family when he first arrives, this young kid?
The story of Ikemefuna is a tragic one. And the fact that he's coming into Okonkwo's family had to do with the tradition of the people, the culture of the people. After his people... cross the boundary, the traditional boundary, by offending the people of Imofia by killing one of their own. The best way to avoid a war was to enslave or to a kind of payback with a virgin as well as a young man. And Ikemefuna, unfortunately, happened to be the young boy offered as a sacrifice, and he came into Okonkwo's womb. Okonkwo is assigned to take care of the boy,
yeah.
And he becomes part and parcel of the womb, and then becomes so close to Nwoye, Okonkwo's only son. And then, in fact, a stage came in which Nwoye actually cannot be differentiated from the members, the authentic members of Okonkwo's family.
Yeah, so he becomes just like another son. Let's find out what happens to this boy in just a minute, because I want to now welcome Professor Gareth Griffiths to the show. He's an expert on African writing. He's at the University of Western Australia. Gareth, welcome back. Nice to have you with us.
Hi, Michael.
Nice to have you on board. So can we go to you now? I know that you were a friend of Chinua Achebe. What was Chinua Achebe's upbringing like? What personal experience does he bring to this story?
Well, quite a considerable amount, though. In fact, this is the first of three novels, two of which deal directly with him. This is really the story of his grandfather's generation. And as John said earlier, set in the 1890s, now in Igbo land, in the eastern part of Nigeria, the colonial incursion occurred, almost a half a century after it had occurred in the western part, in the Yoruba regions in the west. So it's actually Achebe's old grandfather's generation that actually was part of saw the first incursions of white people. So it's very late, even in terms of the colonial incursion. It's also Nwoya, who becomes Isaac, the convert, is very clearly based upon Achebe's own father. His father was, in fact, a convert and became an Anglican catechist. And, in fact, Achebe remained a communicant member of the Anglican Church throughout his life. So, you know, he was brought up, in a sense, by a father who had begun in the traditional society, had converted and then became a catechist of the Christian/colonial society. So it's very much reflecting the period of his own life, not necessarily the absolute detail. I mean, it's not that his Okonkwo is actually his grandfather, but you can see there's a relationship between his family history and what the novel talks about.
Well, he's a man who stands in both cultures, I guess, or in both periods in a way. He's got connections to both periods. Now,
yes.
Have you got the book with you? Got a copy of the
I
book
do.
With you?
Yeah.
Well, I wonder whether you'd mind reading us the opening paragraph, because
sure.
I know you think very highly of this, and it's quite a famous piece of writing. And when I read that it was so famous, I thought, what's all the fuss about? It's such a simple, straightforward piece of writing. But read it to us, and then we'll discuss it.
Okay. It's the opening of the novel goes like this. Okonkwo was well known throughout the nine villages and even beyond. His fame rested on solid personal achievements. As a young man of 18, he had brought honor to his village by throwing Amalintse, the cat. Amalintse was the great wrestler who for 7 years was unbeaten from Umuofia to Mbeno. He was called the cat because his back would never touch the earth. It was this man that Okonkwo threw in a fight, which the old men agreed was one of the fiercest since the founder of their town engaged a spirit of the wild for 7 days and seven nights. Now, as you say, it appears, you know, to be an incredibly simple piece of writing. And in fact, in some ways, it takes us immediately out of what we would think of perhaps as the more complicated world of writing, and sort of, you know, draws us towards some sense of the importance of speech and orality, and that's the simplicity of it. But at the same time, and I'm not the first critic to point this out, the great Kenyan critic Simon Jakandi has actually said that what's important about this paragraph is that it's part of the way in which the novel itself, Things Fall Apart, addresses the inadequacies and failures of the novels written about Africa, about Nigeria, by white writers up until that time. And we talked about this, I think, last month when we were talking about Conrad's Heart of Darkness. And in the case of this novel, basically what happens in those colonial period novels is that there's no sense of an actual character. They're just sort of unnamed Africans. There's no sense of a social context within which they live. Mm. And above all, there's no sense of it being part of a long history. I mean, that one simple paragraph, Achebe manages to show all three of those things. Okonkwo is a real named person with real characteristics. We see the social context of Umuofia and Mbeno and the whole importance of cultural aspects like wrestling. And finally, in that reference to the founding spirit of the town, we see that there's a history to this whole place. So in a very apparently simple paragraph, he's overturned, in fact, you know, three of the main failings of the colonial period representations of Nigerian life.
On RN, you're listening to Books and Arts with Michael Cathcart, and we're in the African Book Club, where we're discussing the novel Things Fall Apart by the Nigerian author Chinua Achebe. And helping us get into the novel are Dr. John Adeleke, who is a Nigerian-Australian academic and writer, Professor Gareth Griffiths, who's an expert on African writing from the University of Western Australia, and Sister Zizanda, who is a storyteller and the organiser of the Pan-African Poets Cafe in Melbourne. And I'd love to know what you've made of this novel. You can talk to us on Facebook. You can tweet us. We're at RN Books and Arts. Or you can text, and the number is 0418 22 65 76. That's 0418 22 65 76. And don't wait until the program is almost over. Do it now, especially if you're in Central Australia. If you're listening in South Australia or in the Territory, you'll have to call now to to beat that time difference. Sue is on Twitter. She says Okonkwo was a classic tragic hero brought down by a fatal flaw, which is his inflexibility, his refusal to accept his feminine side. That's an interesting way of looking at it. And we've also got Helen on our website who says, in Things Fall Apart, Achebe writes back to Conrad's Heart of Darkness, which is, I guess, the point that Gareth was just making. He gives us an Africa in which the Igbo farm He gives us an Africa in which the Igbo farm in connection with the seasons, in contrast to the frenzy and dark chaos of the jungle. Thanks to writers like him and Adichie, we have the opportunity to be enriched by this literature rather than stuck in outmoded and patronising ways of thinking. And Helen's comment goes on at some length, and you can read that on our website. Let's continue with the story of this boy who ends up being killed, this boy who's joined the family, Ikemefuna. John, he ends up being killed. He's slaughtered, in fact. What do you make of the fact that Okonkwo decides to kill this boy who's come from this other village as a sort of tribute, as a kind of compensation for an invasion? He's taken this boy into his own family, treated him as his own son, and then he kills him. Just explain why he kills him.
Just before I go into that, Gareth actually referred to Conrad's creation of Africa. Actually, Achebe consciously sets out to contest imperial stereotypes of Africa in Things Fall Apart and successfully makes the reader acknowledge the existence of other non-Eurocentric cultures and histories as against the Western master narrative, and that Achebe did successfully in the narrative of Things Fall Apart. Now, straight to your question. Okonkwo as a man, a very bold man, as a very strong man, very ambitious man. He has a tall ambition to have four titles. And then, in the case of Ikemefuna, despite the fact that Ikemefuna has become part and parcel of his home, he perhaps should not have had any dealings, no any hand in the killing of Ikemefuna. But you see, he believes that for him not to participate, for him not to be seen in the forefront, of paying obedience to the voice of the gods, that's we make him look like a woman, and it will tell so much about his personality in that society. So, and when it gets to a point when the first man deals Ikemefuna the first blow, Okonkwo summons up the courage and finished the job. But you will discover the sensitivity in Okonkwo days after the killing of Ikemefuna, and he comes back home for about 3 days. Okonkwo was not himself. He could not eat. That shows the sensitivity in his person as a person, And you remember that the man who actually brought to him that, look, Ikemefuna is going to be killed, actually warns him, never you have hand in the killing of this boy. Remember, he calls you father. And then Obiorika, his friend, actually takes him to task about that. Why should you have hand in this, in the death of this man, in the death of a young man who knows you as his father, even in his own son, he's so pissed off.
Yes,
traumatized.
So Sister Zai, let's go to you, because this really goes to the heart of what we make of the culture of this village. And it's hard to read the book without thinking, gosh, it's pretty harsh. You know, the killing of the boy, the idea that Okonkwo, for example, gets crossed with one of his wives, so he shoots a gun at her. I mean, he doesn't hurt her, but, that's a pretty full-on thing to do. To what extent do you think the book is prepared to critique traditional culture? Is it doing that? Is it asking us to think critically about the old ways as well as about the new?
I think we have to go back to that opening paragraph and what Gareth actually highlighted what Achebe was trying to do. Beg your pardon. What Achebe was trying to do was, I think, really focus on characters and not say that a single person is a spokesperson of an entire culture. So what we have here is a story about a man who happens to belong to a particular culture that does have particular beliefs, principles, values, some of which he is, not really following, some of which he does follow maybe to an extreme. So when we talk here, I don't think we can really confuse Okonkwo's behavior and actions with the culture of this particular...
But he sees himself as upholding the culture, doesn't he?
He sees himself as?
As upholding the culture. He sees himself as the sort of orthodox guardian of the culture. But I guess what you're saying is we've got to understand that this culture, like all cultures, is a conversation.
I think it's a conversation. I think everybody sees themselves as a guardian of culture in a way, isn't it? I mean, even us here on the show giving our take on this piece of culture, we all see ourselves as a guardian of culture.
Yeah.
You know, but whether or not our opinions are held by the wider, broader society is another question.
Gareth, for me, this is the hard question and how you think through the way to read the book.
Yeah, well, I think that's, the last comment's really right on the point. I mean, John mentioned Obiorica's warning. And remember in the book what he says is when the oracle of the wizard trees requires that the boy is killed, Obiorica warns Okonkwo that he says, if the oracle said that my son should be killed, I would neither dispute it nor be the one to do it. So, you know, Okonkwo in a sense, he is standing up for the culture. But as a number of people have said about the novel, perhaps Okonkwo is actually standing not just for the culture, but overstating the what he sees as the kind of core of the culture. And that brings us also, I think, to this issue of his fear of being seen to be unmanly. This, you know, the concept of his father, Unoko, being seen as Agbala, as the term which is also the term for a woman, as is also the term for a weak man. And his fear of that is actually immediately afterwards in the novel when he kills Ikemefuna, that we then get the discussion of one of the old men of the society who has just died. And Obiorica and Okonkwo reflect on the fact that the old man and his wife had been incredibly close. And he says, you know, Obiorica says, I remember when I was a young boy, there was a song about them. He could not do anything without telling her. And then Okonkwo's response to that is, he says, I thought he was a strong man in his youth. He was indeed, said Ofuedu. Okonkwo shook his head doubtfully. I mean, he can't really comprehend the idea that you can be strong and at the same time, you know, recognize your feminine side. And that's really overstating the culture, yeah.
That's a really brilliant point as well, because, I mean, when we look at the representation of gender in the book, we have, you know, these tales about, you know, the relationship between the earth and the sky. We know that the yam is the king yam, that's a plant that's associated with manhood, but the women also plant their food alongside the yam. And we know that there are priestesses who are the guardians of certain shrines that belong to male gods. So we see a balance of the genders throughout. And I think what we get with Unoka and Okonkwo is an imbalance of the feminine and an imbalance of the masculine. And so what the novel is actually trying to get at is that And I think a lot of African and cultures, Bantu in origin, would actually say is that there is masculine and feminine within everyone. And that can come up at certain points within the person who has to make a decision about something. In this case, for instance, killing a child it's a very harsh decision. No doubt about that. But, you know, societies here still have the death sentence, and still exercise it. And I think but we also call on, you know, we have justice, laws that are written, but we also have a sense of natural justice, and that is often associated with the feminine, with the nurturing side of ourselves.
So you're saying, Sister Zai, that one of the moral points that the author wants us to take away from this book is that there's a kind of balance required. Is it like a sort of the moral of a Greek legend about all things in moderation, about achieving a harmony here between masculine principles and feminine principles?
Yeah, I would say that. I would say that is the fundamental, that is key and fundamental to any culture that is going to survive is not to have that inflexibility. Inflexibility comes along when you have too much of one and too little of the other.
John Adelica, I'll go to you now, because this issue of the feminine and the masculine is played out in geography after after Okonkwo kills the 16-year-old son of a senior man in the village. And you'd think he might get executed for this, but he's actually sent away in exile for 7 years. And he finds this, I think, quite humiliating, because the country he goes back to in exile is the country of his mother. And he keeps making this contrast between living on his motherland rather than his fatherland. He's not comfortable living on his motherland. They're wasted years in his mind, the years on his motherland. Could you talk to that, John?
Yeah. Yes. You will recall that when Okonkwo gets to his motherland, Banta, and he was downcast. He didn't like what happened to him, a ton of events. His uncle, Uchendu, calls him aside and then tries to admonish him that, look, of course, a child is more of his father. But when the chiefs are down, when there is a trial, a challenge confronting a man, the man becomes the child of his mother. And everyone at the peak of need, at the peak of catastrophe, at the peak of trial, turns to the mother. Which means there is a kind of balance between the two. The woman has a role, and the man, you know, has a role in the society. We can see that.
Can I pop in there? I think yes, the woman and the man have a role, but the concept of the feminine and the masculine is within each person as well, comes out when we look at the character of Chika, who's also the priestess of the of the oracle, is that right?
Yeah.
And she has that ferociousness when she is overcome by that spirit. But when you see her in ordinary life, she's a very soft person. So I think that's a very...
she's a very tough woman when the spirit is on her. I mean, the rulings she makes are hard to go along with.
I think you're right in that perspective, because it has to do with every individual. You have both sides. And then we could see that even in Okonkwo, after the killing of Kemifuna, and he comes home, you can see that feminine aspect of him. And then after he has been spoken to, you know, by his uncle, you know, we discover that Okonkwo becomes a sober man, and he begins to be positive about life. I think you're right about that.
There's also, of course, the interesting figure in the novel of his daughter, Izinba. And it's interesting because, Nawoya, who becomes the convert, he sees as weak, but he adores his daughter, partly because he sees her as a strong person. What's interesting is, of course, that, you know, I agree with everything that's been said about it. The society has a balance of the two, but at the core, of course, Okonkwo recognizes that essentially the Igbo society of the period was predominantly patriarchal. I mean, there was a role for women, but it was not possible for someone like Izinba to achieve or to get the role that Okonkwo sees she should have. And it's one of the ironies, of course, of the history of colonialism in Nigeria, that the second novel that Chebbi writes, Arrow of God, which is set in the 1920s at the time of the revolt against the imposition of indirect rule through the creation of chiefs, which, of course, as we know from this novel, the Igbos did not have. You basically had a meritocracy where you achieved titles rather than hereditary chieftains. And in that period, the revolt against the colonial period was led by the women, because as soon as you moved away from a subsistence economy to a market economy, as a number of Nigerian feminist historians like Emma Nabar pointed out, women actually became the center of the economy. So women actually, and in fact, the revolt in the 1920s is called the Women's War. So, you you know, there's a possibility down the track for somebody like Zinma to emerge as a very powerful figure in the society. But at the time of this novel, it's not possible. And, you know, I think that's, I think the whole gender thing is very complicated in the novel. But can I return to a point that Michael made earlier about, you know, this is a very harsh society?
Yes.
I mean, it seems to me that one of the most important things about the book and why it is such a powerful account is that Achebe is trying to go back and celebrate the culture before colonialization, but he never idealizes it. He doesn't present it as a kind of idyll, you know, some wonderful world in the past that's been lost. He presents it as a fully complex human society that, like every human society, has got bad and good aspects. I mean, the casting out of twins, for example, into the forest, you know, which is an Igbo practice. By the way, as John would know very well, it's not a Yoruba practice. In Yoruba culture, you know, twins are regarded very highly. But in the Igbo culture, they're regarded as bad luck, and they cast out into the evil forest. Similarly with, you know, the whole the idea of taking prisoners and then having that prisoner Ikemefuna killed. There are so many aspects to this culture that you know, are not ideal. And Achebe doesn't shrink from putting it fully in front of us. It's saying, you know, this is like every society. It's complex, it's difficult, it's got its good sides, it's got its bad sides. And I think that's what makes it such a powerful account.
Well, Gareth, thank you for laying that on the table, because to me as a white reader, that's the challenge of the book. Because on the one hand, I'm thinking, look, it's not my place to judge this culture. On the other hand, I'm thinking, but that's not very good. This is a very patriarchal culture. It is very violent, letting twins die, killing people because the gods or the authorities say that this boy should be killed, beating up your wife. These are, by definition, not good things in any society wherever they occur. So when do you have the humility to look at someone else's culture and say, it's not for me to judge? And when do you say, no, as a human being, I feel that's a culture that I can critique? Sisters, how do you stand?
I think you're talking about power. This is an issue of power, and I think that the whole novel is about the power and who has the power to speak on behalf of certain groups, who has the power to critique other groups. And then there's some groups that are beyond critique and have always have been beyond critique. When we have an African novel that critiques the arrival of, you know, colonization, and we have an African novel that critiques urbanization and industrialization, then we might have a novel that actually critiques groups in society that are never open to critique. Groups in society that used, like, the civilizing mission, as you would have seen in Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, to actually go out and conquer other places and pillage and plunder. And so, yeah, I think, you know, I think it's always difficult to move through any society without some form of judgment. But we always have to ask ourselves, where are those values and principles coming from? Because often what happens is those who are in the position who have the power to judge and then have the power because of that power, then able to exercise some action, are often taught that they have no culture, that Europe is the silent referent.
Well, that's the...
And that's the whole thing about things fall apart. I think it is to present us with something very complex, a very complex society, that because of the weaknesses within it, it becomes open to colonization.
All truth ultimately is about wrestling with contradictions, it seems to me. You know, and I guess that's what this makes us do, what art makes us do. This is Books and Arts on RN, and we're in the African Book Club, and the novel this month is Things Fall Apart by the Nigerian author Chinua Achebe. A deceptively simple book, it's turning out. A marvellous read. I hope you've enjoyed reading it, and I'm sure this discussion will persuade you to read it if you haven't. And helping us to talk about the novel are Dr. Jen Adeleke, who is a Nigerian-Australian academic and writer, Professor Gareth Griffiths, who's an expert on African writing at the University of Western Australia, and Sister Zai Zanda, who's a storyteller and the organiser of the Pan-African Poets Cafe in Melbourne. So let's move on now to the issue we really have arrived at already, which is the period of colonisation. So right at the end of the book, the colonists arrive, the missionaries show up. John, initially, what is the impact that the colonists have on the village where the story is set?
Thank you for that question. The impact of colonialism on the Igbo society, as we have seen in Things Fall Apart, and then the reaction and the comments of the administrator at the end of the old episode, where he tries to reduce Okonkwo to a mere insignificant figure, you know, in whatever book he plans to write, actually signifies that the West has no respect, has no value for African culture at that material time. And then what Okonkwo tries to do, you know, by standing and defending the culture of the people, and as if he was fighting the colonial masters all alone, without his people standing by him, actually shows that he is like a lone tree, a lone fighter. And at the end of the day, when he sees that, look, the people, what I'm trying to defend, you know, people are not rallying around me. They are not sharing the same opinion, the same view with me. And he feels, well, I can't stand by this. I cannot stand by this. And decides to take his life.
Yeah, yeah.
And for the administrator to now say, well, it's just to reduce Okonkwo's story to that of maybe a paragraph or a single line, whatever book he tries to write, actually impact negatively on whatever the narrative tries to portray.
What do we make, Sister Zai, of the fact that Okonkwo takes his life? So what happens is the missionaries move in and they recruit people to their religion. They build a church. The missionaries build a church in the village. In fact, they give the leaders of the village, give the missionaries land in the, what's it called,
the evil forest.
The evil forest, thinking that that'll knock the church over, but the church survives and prospers, which is a sign that to some people that the new religion is actually very powerful. And Okonkwo ends up resisting this, but he, at the end of the day, he commits suicide, or we don't say commit suicide now, he suicides. What do you make of that? Because some critics see this as an act of cowardice on his part.
I think that's the question I'm constantly left grappling with in this book. He spent 7 years in his mother's village, you know, and so when he returns, he knows that there's a lot of changes have occurred. And for him, he calls these the wasted years, yeah, because he won't be able to achieve the goals he set out for himself in his life. So his own concept of masculinity is challenged, I think, at the core with the arrival of the missionaries who have essentially taken his eldest son and who have now turned his kinsmen into what he sees as cowards, because his kinsmen will no longer go to war. And Umuofia was like this very feared village because of not only the medicine that they had with the spirits, but also because of their excellence at war.
They were tough.
They were tough people. And so he, I think, you know, he commits this act and he knows that there's going to be consequences for his actions. And rather than be tried in you know, according to the principles and the values of a system that he has absolutely no respect for, he decides to take his own life. And that's challenging. I mean, it's challenging for me as the reader because it's a complete, it's not what you would expect for the kind of character that has been set forth for us.
Well,
you could
see him as an existential hero. He could be a man who says, I do have a choice. I could take my own life. Or see it as an act of protest too.
Well, you know, and that's another thing is that, yeah, sometimes we do have to look at these acts, you know, the choice to take one's, yeah, life as an act of protest, and also maybe overwhelm as well. You know, maybe this is a man who, I don't know. I mean, obviously we're going into territory and era that hasn't been written in the book, but maybe this is a man who doesn't know how to express his emotions or his feelings of sadness and doesn't know how to cope with this loss. You know, of a society that...
That's a very gentle reading of him.
It is very gentle.
Gareth, what do you make of it?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because, of course, I mean, the important thing is that in terms of the traditional society, suicide is an act, again, one of the several offences Kwankwo commits against the Earth Mother Goddess. And that's why... You know, they have to wait for the Kotmas, the court messengers of the district officer to bring him down from the tree because he's polluted. They can't touch him. So, in a strange way, there is an element. I think Sister said earlier there was an element of, and people have talked about this, I think both rightly and wrongly, as being Chebbi's attempt at writing a tragedy, and therefore, in a sense, like Greek tragedy, there is this issue about pollution, offence, hubris, all these concepts, I think can be seen to work through the novel. I mean, we have to remember that Acebi was educated at Ibadan University, where, the things studied were basically classic English literature, and his great friend, the poet Christopher Okibo, actually graduated in classics, Latin and Greek. So, Acebi is somebody who has a complete knowledge of that, and I think that moment at the end is the moment where, we are aware of this man has been forced not only to kill himself, but, it's an act of pollution. But there's a broader sense here, too, it seems to me, in what's happening, because I think the figure we're leaving out, in a way, of the discussion is that crucial figure of Nawayer Isaac. Now, Nawayer, who becomes Isaac, the eldest son who converts, is quite clearly, as it were, looking forward to Achebe's own father. And what's interesting at the end of the novel is there's a huge tragedy that a Concour and the traditional way of fighting a war cannot, in the end, resist the impact of colonization. It's too technically superior. It's too powerful. So, then you look forward to what happens in the next generation. And oddly enough, of course, it's the generation of people like Nawayer Isaac who, through conversion, get European education, and their children, Achebe's generation, become the leaders of the new society. They become, if you like, the anti-colonial powers. They are the people who lead Nigeria to independence. So Nawayer Isaac's, in a sense, is betrayal at one level of the traditional culture. Also, in a way, is what enables the generation that follows him to resist it in a different form. So it's quite a complex figure. And, in fact, Nawayer Isaac features very powerfully in the third novel, No Longer at Ease, which is the story of Okonkwo's grandson. And quite clearly at that point in time in the third novel, I mean, it's very interesting. Achebe once said that three of the books were published as what was called the African Trilogy. That's Things Fall Apart, Arrow of God, and No Longer at Ease. But of course, the second one, Arrow of God, is not really part of the family trilogy because it has a different village. It's Umuaria, the character is Udu, it's different. And in fact, Nawayer Isaac's story is told at the beginning of the third novel. And the whole business about how he achieves his kind of route to power. So I think what is so wonderful about Achebe's novel is that it's, and his writing generally, is that he's never satisfied with simple questions. He's always teasing out the complexities that are going on behind every moment of the novel.
On RN, this is Books and Arts with Michael Cathcart, and you're in the African Book Club, where we're discussing Things Fall Apart by the Nigerian author Chinua Achebe. And as Gareth was explaining, it's part one of a trilogy of three novels. We've been talking about the first one this morning. With us are Professor Gareth Griffiths, who's an expert on African writing. He's from the University of Western Australia. Also in the studio, Dr. John Adeleke, who is a Nigerian-Australian academic and writer, and Sister Zai Zanda, who is the organiser of the Pan-African Poets Cafe in Melbourne. John, let's continue that line of questioning, because here we have this novel written by this new generation, this generation that have African heritage and this Western education. It's a novel written in English. What do you make of the fact that the novel is in the language of the colonizer?
That's a very interesting question. I think what Achebe did laid a kind of foundation that other African writers will build. We cannot talk about this language without actually referring to the issue of the first meeting in 1962 by African writers of English expression, where these writers gathered together to fashion out what precisely of African literature, you know? Is it a fiction about Africa, written by Africa, Africans, or a story of Africa written by non-Africans? And at the end of the day, the decision was that, look, we cannot help but to succumb to the supremacy of English language, and that what we should do is to refashion, to reinvent English language, to express, you know, African experience. That was, and Things Fall Apart was published about 3 years before that meeting, which means Achebe must have foreseen this situation, the dilemma in which African writers will find itself. And if you read Chinua Achebe very well, it might be very difficult for some people to look at, to read Chinua Achebe and not be able to contextualize it, to be able to give proper interpretation to some issues there. Because there are certain expressions that English language does not have a capability to carry. And what Achebe has done in Things Fall Apart is to refashion, to remold that English language. And where it is outrightly impossible for him, like the use of chi, he actually introduced it, interjected into it. And I can draw example from my own Yoruba language. Each time I write and I'm confronted with this kind of linguistic dilemma, you know, what I try to do, where I cannot really refashion English language, I deliberately bring in that indigenous concept of it. Like, let me give you an example. Like when we say ulemosu, as we have chi in Things Fall Apart, you see, when you say ilemosu, a woman is in ilemosu, it simply means that the marriage, you know, of that woman is in crisis, and the woman has left her matrimonial home for her father's house to stay there permanently. And if I am going to use that concept and try to use English language to express it, I may end up with a whole chapter instead of just one single word.
Let's pass this around, John, because time is short, and I'd love to hear what the others have got to say about this. And there's just time to take some listener feedback. We've got about 5 minutes to go, but if you'd like to text me on 0418 22 65 76, 0418 22 65 76, I'd love to know what you've made of this discussion. Or you can tweet us at RN Books and Arts, and of course you can talk to us on Facebook. Sister Zai, what do you make of this question? This question of writing in the language of the colonizer. Is that an issue, or is that just a kind of academic construct as a problem?
It's an issue. It's an issue, and not just for, I mean, this is an issue for all writers from the diaspora, regardless of which generation, era, and place where they are located. I'll come from this from what I call a black performance art perspective, where we're constantly trying to, as John was indicating, constantly trying to provide new content for words that are actually really reductive of our experiences and reductive of how we see ourselves and how we want to be represented.
What sort of words?
Oh, my goodness, black.
Okay.
African.
Yeah.
You know, all of those carry, it's very loaded language, you know. As soon as you say that, what are the first words or first images that pop into your mind? And it's probably very different. I mean, this is the whole reason why Achebe wrote Things Fall Apart, so that he could expand the notion and the idea of what Africa is and what this Igbo society is, you know, or was at that particular point in time. So the choice to write in English is a double-edged sword. I think it's a powerful decision to make because the language of the colonizer, you know, the sun never set on the British Empire. This book is now widely read amongst people across the world. So it gives us a common language through which we can resist through art, I would say. And that resistance is to resist the stories that have been told about us. You know, so it's a double-edged sword still to use English, this limiting language, as Audre Lorde, a black feminist writer from the United States, would say. You can't use the master's tools to dismantle the master's house. You can use the master's tools, I would say, to critique the master's house to a degree.
Okay. I'm not sure how you critique a house. I suppose you could critique a house.
Well, the master's house is, you know, the way that things are done. The accepted, you know, this is the district commissioner's last, you know, his idea for a story is, oh, maybe I'll just write a paragraph about this man and, you know, and call it. And he has like, you know, what is it? What does he want to call this book? The taming, the pacification of the primitive tribes of the Lower Niger. I mean, the word tribe is so loaded. I particularly don't like that tribe.
So just to explain, one of the missionaries, the tough guy missionary, is it the missionary who says he'll do
it's
this?
It's the district commissioner.
Oh, the district commissioner. Yes, that's right. He says that he's going to take the story, including the story of Okonkwo's death, and. He says he had already chosen the title of the book after much afterthought, The Pacification of the Primitive Tribes of the Lower Niger. Is that how we say it?
I would say the Lower Niger, yes.
Yeah.
And so, and for me, I mean, that's a very classic situation where people are walking into a very complex, dynamic society with preconceived notions of what to expect. So what they don't see the complexity. Mm. They don't see that at all. Or they impose their own limiting beliefs onto that society. If you were to walk into a place and accept that it is a complex, you would actually start taking on aspects of that place's language. Yeah. You know, so and that's relevant to a lot of places around the world.
Time is up, but we've just got 30 seconds each. Gareth, as we wind up, what would you say is the significance of this novel? What claim do you want to make for this book?
Well, in a way, the last thing is quite clear, that although it's written in English, right at the end of the novel, what we become aware of is that the entire world that the novel is recording in English is actually being spoken in Igbo. And so right at the very end, when the district commissioner, you know, says this, he can't understand Obiorika's protest, and the messenger shouts, "Shut up." And then he says, "Quite unnecessarily." It's unnecessary because the commissioner can't understand what Obiorika is saying. You know,
true.
So the entire novel is actually written in English, but the culture that it represents is in fact Igbo. And the same thing with those words like Obi or Chai or Chi. I mean, these words actually, in a sense, are metonymic of the whole absent culture that the book records in English. So, you know, it seems to me that that's the moment where, as with wonderful thing with novels, when we read that final section of the novel, suddenly we flash back through the entire book and realize that what we have actually been looking at is a society that is not in English, that is in Igbo, that is in fact a totally other society that we then have to come to terms with. Mm-hmm. And that's what the magnificent moment at the end of the book, suddenly, you know, how novels can do this, with the only form that can do this, that, you know, suddenly you read something later in a novel and suddenly you're forced to reconsider everything you've thought about the novel up until that moment. And so that seems to me to be, you know, that what, if I could put it into a single sentence, this celebrates the Igbo culture, but celebrates it in its totality, in its complexity, and it does it, as Sister said, by employing the master's voice to critique the master's house. You know, that's essentially what it does.
It's a great line. Sister Zai, we've got 30 seconds.
Well, you know, yes, it's exactly that. You know, you can't use the master's tools to change the master's house.
So, but ultimately, that's what this book is about. Is that as we assess the significance of the book? That's the significance.
The significance of the book, definitely, and is to see art as a space where we can actually resist as well. It's not just in violence and in war.
John, as we wind up, just your final comment in 30 seconds. What's the significance of this book? What do you want us to take away from this discussion?
Yes, I think what Achebe actually achieved in that is about the language, because it's a kind of search for a literary identity for the emerging African literature, just as Bill Ashcroft and, of course, Gareth is on this panel this morning said in the Empire Writes Back, observed that post-colonial writing needed to constitute a language that would suit its purpose. The crucial function of language as a medium of power demands that post-colonial writing define itself by seizing the language of the center and replacing it in a discourse fully adapted to the colonized place. And that was precisely what Achebe did.
Thank you, John. It's been good to talk to all three of you. Dr. Jenna Adeleke, Professor Gareth Griffiths and Sister Zai Zander, thank you so much for being on the panel this morning. Thank you to all of you who got in touch. Tomorrow, Sarah Konoski is with you for Books and Arts. Book to Film is part of the show tomorrow. We're going to look at The Jungle Book, which is a nice segue, isn't it? And Earshot's next. And Andrew Ford is talking to Ben Quilty, the final in their series of talking about what it's like to be creative people who live, well, almost next door to each other. I'm Michael Cathcart. This is RN. Bye-bye.